Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of True Crime Boulevard. I'm your host, Bree, and this week we're going to be doing a true crime episode. It's a wrestling case, and I'm super excited. If you guys remember from like my second episode when I was doing the Chris Benoit case, you guys know I'm a huge fan of wrestling. I kind of got in the wrestling game kind of late in life. I was probably like 21, 22 when I really got into wrestling. I'd seen wrestling on and off, whatever. I talk about it in episode 2. So if you want to go back and check out that episode, please do, because that's a really interesting case as well. But recently, not recently, but over the last like maybe like 2 years, Vice has had this really dope documentary series called Dark Side of the Ring. And I've really been listening to it. I enjoy it a lot. So this episode is coming from that particular docuseries. So a lot of information that I'm getting for this particular case is strictly from that docuseries. They did a very, very, very good job of discussing this case, going in detail of like really what really happened during the case itself. Obviously, I had to go back and do my own research, and I'll put the links to everything, like all the research that I did outside of the docuseries for like his early life, because I'm not gonna wail. He, the wrestler we're gonna be talking about today, his name is Bruiser Brody. He is a wrestler from like the 70s, 80s, late 60s, like that period of time. So there's not a lot of information about his life when he was younger. There's a lot of information about his career, but his like personal life, especially because of that time, there really isn't a lot of information. So I did the best that I could, so don't hate me. So real quick content warning, we're gonna be talking about a stabbing death today. That's really the only content warning for this one. We're gonna be talking about wrestling and maybe a little brutalization every now and again, because you know, it's wrestling and it's the 70s and 80s. So yeah, oh, and a heads up. So over the next couple of weeks, I'm probably going to be hitting on a few more, well, I'm definitely going to be hitting on a few more wrestling cases, because WrestleMania season is here. And again, I'm a very big wrestling fan, and WrestleMania weekend is like my Super Bowl Sunday. So just know that you guys are going to be inundated with like a bunch of random wrestling true crime cases that nobody talks about, because they're like really small and a lot of them happened in like the 80s and 90s, and they were kind of crazy. Some of these cases are really wild. So all that to say, we're gonna go ahead and hop into this. Like I say every week, if anything that's talked about in this episode is too hard for you right now, remember to take care of yourself and your mental health, and I'm sure you'll be able to join us in a future episode. Alrighty, so this week we're going to be talking about Frank Goodish, or again, better known as Bruiser Brody. He was born June 18th, 1946 in Union, Pennsylvania. Brody was a pretty tall guy. Like, he was tall, he was pretty big. Like, when he got to full height and size, he was 6'8", and he was about 300 pounds. He was a big guy, okay? And you gotta think, 60s, 70s, like, they are booking him as a giant. But backing up a little bit, he played football for most of his life. He played in his childhood. He played up until his early adult years. He played at Texas A&M University, which back when he was going there, it was called West Texas University. He got married in 1968, but that marriage was short-lived. They were only together for about 2 years, and they got divorced in 1970. But during that time, he started training with the very famous slash infamous Von Erich family. I'm so sorry if you guys can hear those sirens in the back. Nothing I can do about that. I do apologize, though. But yeah, so he starts training with the Von Erich family, specifically the patriarch of the family, Fritz Von Erich. Kind of debating if I want to do an episode on that, because they're just kind of like, it's just a very sad story. It's not really like anything true crime related, so I doubt that I'll do it. But I might link some places that you can go and like listen to their story if you would like to hear about it. So yeah, he starts training with the Von Erich family. They're a very, very big known family in the wrestling business, especially in the 70s and 80s. And then he started freelancing. He started going around to different territories as a professional wrestler. And because he was a freelancer, he was able to travel a lot more than if he was just like really assigned to like one particular area. So basically meaning like in the 60s, 70s, 80s, some of the 90s, there were territories. So you had like the Southeastern territory, the, you know, Southwest, Midwest, Northeast. So you had places like WWF, which is the prelude to the WWE, the wrestling company that basically almost everybody knows about. You have WCCW, which is World Class Championship Wrestling, which is the company that the Von Erichs owned. And then you had AWA, which is the American Wrestling Association. These are all just different territories throughout the U.S. that he traveled. He also traveled across the country. I mean, not across the country, across the globe, and went to different countries. But because he was able to travel like this, because he was able to go to different territories, he was able to start building feuds and relationships with different companies and build relationships with the audience that he was working. So he was able to work with people like Abdullah the Butcher, Kamala the Ugandan Giant. These were really big names. He got to work with Bruno Sammartino. Like, these are big names in wrestling. These were people who held like championship belts in their respective territory. So he was doing a lot of that. He was just kind of bouncing around, and he was a big guy himself. So that helped him be able to promote himself as this giant, as this guy who didn't lose. And for the most part, like, he didn't lose. There's a few matches he has lost, but like, he was mostly known for not losing. He was known for being tough, for being kind of brutal. Like, he wasn't just called Bruiser Brody, you know, because it rhymed. Like, no, he was a bruiser. Like, you walked out there, you had some marks and bruises when you left, friend. So that was, you know, how he was able to promote himself. So by 1976, Bruiser Brody goes to Vincent J. McMahon, who is the father to Vincent Kennedy McMahon, who, if you're in wrestling, we love to hate him. We love to hate him. So Vincent J. McMahon, his father, was running the WWWF at the time in like the Northeastern territory. So you had like New York, Maine, all those states up there. His father was running that. Vincent Kennedy McMahon's father, Vincent J. McMahon, was running that territory. It gets confusing. I'm sorry, guys. Brody goes to the McMahon's. He puts out this match, and they're like, sure, come in, do this match with Bruno Sammartino, who at the time was the heavyweight championship, and like, he wasn't losing. They weren't gonna let Bruno Sammartino lose in New York to some guy who's not in their company, who's not a part of their territory. It's just a guy kind of stopping through. So he doesn't win the match, but it builds this feud, it builds this huge arc that allows him to constantly be able to come in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out. So that allows him to be able to continue to build his name. He had been traveling to Japan and all kinds of different places. But again, he's working with the McMahon family. He kept coming back to the McMahons. And at one point, he goes on to wrestle a man by the name of Jose Gonzalez. He beat the crap out of Jose Gonzalez, and this is really where I'm going to bring in the Vice documentary, because they really focused on like the case and what kind of led up to the case. So they get into this, it's a match, it's a staged match, it's a traditional wrestling match, or it's supposed to be, but it goes very south very quick. He gets the crap beat out of him by, Jose gets the crap beat out of him by Brody, because Brody just wasn't going for no BS. At this point, Brody had been in the business since like 1968, 69. This is 1980. I'm sorry, about like 1980 when him and Jose are having their first match. So he'd been in the business almost 20 years, like 15 years. He was like, yeah, no, I'm not going to just do anything. And he wasn't just going to put Jose over and just sell to Jose because that's what, you know, quote unquote, that's what good business is. Like, no, if you want me to sell this match, you want this match to go good, then we need to be able to sit and have a conversation and do that. And it didn't work out for Bruiser and Jose in that moment. And so Jose got his ass beat. And all Jose was really trying to do was just make a name for himself. But he was trying to use Brody to make a name for himself. And he probably could have successfully done that had he had just gone about it a different way, other than saying, like, oh, I'm just going to kick your ass. And Bruiser was like, yeah, okay, friend, let's go ahead. So, and like I said, Bruiser wasn't going for just anything. Like, he, real talk, he kind of liked things perfect. Like, if he ain't fuck with you, he ain't fuck with you. If he likes you, he likes you. It was what it was. And you was going to find out exactly how he felt in that ring. And if you didn't work with him, if you didn't talk to him, if you didn't communicate with him, he was not going to give you the match you thought you were going to get. He wouldn't work you. He wouldn't sell you. He wouldn't do shit. And that was just going to be the end of the conversation for him. And that caused a very big sense of tension between Jose and Brody that would fester for years. Like, they just had this issue between the two of them because, you know, Jose never got put over. So fast forward to 1986, Brody is kind of in this place where, like, people are kind of tired of the hard-headedness. They're tired of, like, not tired, but, like, they're getting a little frustrated. People are getting frustrated with some of the things that he's doing. And, like, if you ask Abdul the Butcher, when he talks about him and Brody and how they wrestled and the things they do, like, Abdul will tell you, like, I'm not a wrestler. I don't do holds and grapples and all that stuff. I do karate. I do jujitsu. I fight. You know what I'm saying? So a lot of people, it was starting to get to a heightened place for a lot of people where they're just like, we don't know what to do. So Brody ends up kind of making the decision to kind of go into, like, a promotion kind of thing, funding a wrestling promotion so that he can make money, but also, like, he kind of has, like, a home. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's been floating for so long, he doesn't have a home. There's no territory that he really belongs to. And it seems like he was just trying to find, like, a solid territory that would be his, that he could go to and that he could not have to worry about anything. And so a major reason why a lot of people really were thinking that, like, oh, he's gonna invest in a promotion soon, is because there were conversations between a person who did, like, promotion and owned wrestling venues and stuff in Puerto Rico. His name was Victor Quiñones. And then there was a even bigger promoter and owner who Victor works with named Gorilla Monsoon. And they felt like there was a lot of people thought, like, you know, Brody's been talking to these people. There was some money that was owed to Brody, and he had made sure that he was going to get his money. But there was also some other things that were going on, and everybody was like, oh, okay, it seems like there's something going on here. So, like I said, he had traveled all over the world at this point, so he was very well known. But I'm going to take a little bit of a pause in all of this. In all of his travels all around the world, this would allow him to meet his second wife, Barbara Smith. And in 1980, they had their first son, which would be their only son, sadly. But they had a child together, and Barbara was very happy with him. She said he was like when he was home, he was Frank. And when he went on the road, he was Bruiser. So, like, he was two different people. Like, he truly would live two different lives. That, I think, also is, I think personally, probably is why one of the reasons he wanted to kind of, like, go into business for himself. It allows him to be home more. Like she was saying, like, out of a year, he was only home for, like, 3 months out of the year because of how much he traveled. And the fact that he was, like, this freelance wrestler, he had to promote himself. He had to make sure his name stayed out there. He had to make sure that he was always good business, meaning that, you know, his name always carried weight. His name always brought money. So he had to be good business. So that's part of the reason why it's hard to really find anything about his personal life and anything that happened, you know, in his childhood and stuff, because he doesn't talk about it. He did a very good job of keeping the character alive for the audience, for the people that are watching. So yeah, for almost 20 years, he does this. You know, built this amazing career, and he was still wrestling, obviously. He was still wrestling, but he was looking to go into business for himself, and he's looking in Puerto Rico. So July 16th, 1988, Bruiser is in Puerto Rico. He's there for a wrestling show for a promotion down there. He's getting ready for his match. He has breakfast. He works out with Tony Atlas, who is there. He, you know, is doing his regular thing. People see him all day, all morning. They're talking to him. Like I said, Tony Atlas and Brody worked out together that day. And Brody kind of hit, you know, gave him, like, you know, the little hint, like, yo, things about to change, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm about to, you know, be in there or whatever. And he was like, okay, cool, you know, that's what's up, bro. So the day goes on, and for the most part, especially, like, the main eventers, like, the top people, they're already at the arena. So when Tony Atlas leaves the hotel, he looks over and he sees Dutch Mantel, but he also sees Brody sitting there. Just, they're waiting for Jose Gonzalez to pick him up, but Tony at the time doesn't know that. He's like, yo, why are you still sitting here? And he's like, I'm waiting on Jose. And he's like, that's weird, like, Jose never came and picked you up. Dutch is kind of having the same feelings, like, that's kind of weird, you know. He's like one of the main events, like, he's one of the top people on the card. How do you forget to pick him up? So they finally get to the arena. Once they get there, they walk into the locker room, and when they walk into the locker room, they see that Jose Gonzalez is in the locker room, and he's talking to Carlos Colon. He is a WWE Hall of Famer. He also is a promoter in Puerto Rico. He's a very big wrestler in Puerto Rico. And Victor Quiñones. They are all sitting there having a conversation, which to Dutch Mantel in the documentary, he says that was strange because he had never seen all three men sitting in the same room like this together having this kind of, like, conversation. Like, it was weird. The energy was very much weird. The room was tense. Everybody was just kind of uncomfortable. So Jose eventually leaves the room. Dutch Mantel says he leaves the room, and he, like, goes to just kind of, you know, get some fresh air, let the room kind of subside from all the tension. Tony Atlas pulls out his sketch pad, and he starts doodling. He's drawing or whatever, and Brody comes over and, you know, kind of just sees, I don't know, what he is doing. And when he looks, he's like, oh shit, bro, like, you can really draw, like, you're really good at this. And he pulls out this picture of his son from, like, this little thing he had, like, I'm assuming it's like his wallet or something. He pulls out a picture of his son, and he's basically asking Tony, like, hey, can you draw a picture of my son for me? Like, can you do this thing for me? And as they're talking about it, Jose Gonzalez comes back in the room. Dutch Mantel comes back in the room. Like, everybody's kind of coming back in, because, again, there is a match that night, so, like, people have to get ready. So people are coming back into the locker room, and as Tony and Brody are having this conversation, Jose comes back in the locker room, and he has something in his hand, but it's covered with a towel, and so nobody actually knew what was in his hand. And he calls Brody into the shower area so they can kind of talk business, talk, you know, matches or whatever, which is not unusual. That is not an unusual occurrence in wrestling, especially back then. That is not an unusual occurrence to be, like, in the locker room talking about the match, talking about what you guys' plans are, what the spots are, what the finishes are. Like, these are normal things. People talking about business back in the day, these are normal things. So it's not like people are like, what are you doing? Why are you in the back talk? Like, it's not a thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know how else to describe it. Like, it's just a thing that they do. So yeah, Brody goes in the back. He goes to have this conversation with Jose. And the next thing Tony hears is, like, this guttural scream. He hears it twice. The first time he's like, what the fuck? And he kind of just looks up and he sees Brody, and, like, Brody's holding his stomach and he's hunched over, and he sees Jose, but he's like, oh shit, Jose just punched Brody in the stomach. Like, that's his thought process. Like, he's not thinking something's wrong. And then he hears the scream again, and when he looks up this time and he looks over, Jose has pulled the knife straight up, like he's about to, like, try to stab Brody, like, in the side of the neck. Like, the knife's all the way in the air, and he, like, gets up and spears or tackles Brody, like, just to get him out of the way. And in the process of doing that, Jose, like, still brings the knife down, and when the knife comes down, it chops off, like, a part of Brody's ponytail. And Carlos Colon was in the room. He jumps up, he goes for Jose, he tries to get the knife, He's like trying to get Jose to calm down. Tony's with Brody on the floor and he's, you know, looking to see like what the damage is. He's like, he sees his intestines. His Tony's arm was covered in blood. Brody was like, make sure they don't hurt me no more. Make sure they don't hurt me no more. And of course, like, Tony's like, bro, what the fuck? Like, who else was there? Like, I just know Jose was there. Like, who else? Like, who else is in this? And it was just chaos in the back. So it took the ambulance about 45 minutes to get to the back where Brody was. And then once the ambulance got back there, they couldn't pick him up. Again, this man is 6'8", 300 pounds. They could not pick him up. So Tony ends up picking him up and putting him on the gurney so they can get him in the truck. Tony rides with him to the ambulance. He said the whole time through all of this, he had his son's picture in his hand and he never let that shit go. And it's just, that tells you how much he really loved his son. Like, he would not, like, let go of that picture. Like, he, you know, like, he's terrified. I would be terrified as a parent. Like, I just got stabbed in the stomach. Like, I don't know if I'm gonna live. I got stabbed twice in the stomach. Like, yeah, no, that's scary. So they get to the hospital and Tony is freaking out because there's nobody checking on him. Nobody has come to see if he is okay. Nobody has come to see the damage. Like, nobody's really doing anything. Now, there are two reasons behind why nobody did anything. One, they are wrestlers and they don't really get super worried about wrestlers because wrestlers pull stunts. Wrestlers work the audience. Wrestlers work people in general. So they really weren't taking it serious at first because he was a wrestler. And then when Tony goes to the doctor and he's like, yo, my friend got stabbed, they were like, yo, stabs here are like a cold in the US, bro. Like, what do you want me to do? Okay, he'll be all right. Give me a second. I'm gonna beat her. Tony was like, nah, bro, you don't understand. My friend got stabbed in the stomach, bro. And he like scooped the doctor up and carried the doctor in the room. And so the doctor finally is like, look, he's like, fine. He looks at him and he realizes like, oh shit, this is bad. So he starts calling in nurses and everybody and they rush him into surgery. Tony is flipping shit. He's punching holes in the wall. Like, he's pissed. Like, he's angry. And so eventually the doctors come out and they're like, hey, he's okay. You know, we have him right now. He's stable. You gotta go because you're scaring the nurses and doctors here. So he was asked to leave the hospital. So he leaves the hospital. He goes back to the arena. Now, this is the thing about wrestling that will forever fucking drive me up a fucking wall. Why in the actual fuck do y'all have this, you know, the show must go on theory when it comes to death? Like, somebody dies backstage and your response is the show must go on. What the actual fuck is wrong with y'all? And this is why I left the wrestling business when the fuck I did. Cause you're not finna look me in my face. I dropped to my fucking death and oh, well, the show must go on. Kiss my whole ass. So Tony gets back and he goes in the locker area and basically everybody is standing around talking, joking, cackling, ki-ki-ki, like nothing fucking happened. And that just made Tony go the fuck off. He threw a chair in the hallway. The cops were like, hey, 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 calm down, calm down. Did you see what happened? Were you here? You know, did you see the crazed fan? And he said, what? Did see the who? They were like, yeah, everyone's telling us that it was a crazed fan that stabbed him. And he was like, nah, it's the motherfucker in that room right there. And he pointed to Jose like, no, it is that dude. He is the one who did this. Like, it wasn't just some crazed fan. And so the cops are like, okay, so the cops get his statement. Tony ends up going out to wrestle that night. He goes out and wrestles. I believe he said he wrestled Abdullah. I don't remember. Don't kill me, guys. He went out to wrestle. Whoever he talked to, like, literally the match went on for like 1 to 2 minutes, he said, because once he realized what happened, once the other wrestler had realized what was happening, my man was like, yeah, I gotta get up out of here, bro. This shit's not gonna go well. Which kind of makes me look at that wrestler, which is why I really think that it was Abdullah. Sorry, my dog is losing his mind. The reason I think it was Abdullah is because Abdullah was the first wrestler to get the fuck out. Like, he got the fuck. He was, like, on the first flight out. So, yeah, all this stuff is going on. It's getting crazy. Tony is like, that's, like, what they're saying is not true. A crazed fan didn't do this. Jose did this. He goes and works his, he goes and does his match. He comes back and there's a wrestler holding his belongings like, yo, get the fuck out of Dodge. Like, the wrestlers are talking. the Puerto Rican wrestlers are talking, get the fuck out of Dodge. Because they about to start coming for you, bro, because you talking. And he's like, what you mean? Like, why are they coming for me? Like, that was Jose. And he did, I don't give a fuck. You know what I'm saying? Like, they don't care. Nigga, you're talking. Tony, you're the one talking. So you need to get the fuck out of Dodge. So Tony basically said he took all his shit out the locker room. Out, you know, somebody went to the hotel and got his shit and brought it to him. And he just paced the beach all night looking over his shoulders, you know, making sure wasn't nobody gonna try and stab him, you know what I'm saying, or hurt him. He ends up going back to the hotel the next day. But Dutch Mantel went back to the hotel that night. And when he gets to the hotel, he calls Brody's wife. He tells her what's going on. He's been injured. You need to come to Puerto Rico. So what does she do? She gets the fuck up. She goes to Puerto Rico. But in the course of that night, Brody's injuries would get worse. Not that they got worse, but like the extent of his injuries would not get any better. Like there was nothing anybody could do at that point. His wounds were so bad. His intestines were basically eviscerated. And they did an autopsy, and the autopsy was just like, yeah, there's nothing more you guys could have done. Like, his intestines were completely eviscerated. There's nothing anybody was going to be able to do. He basically bled out and died. Dutch Mantel was the first person to find out the news that Brody was dead. He went to the front desk of the hotel and was like, hey, can you call the hospital so we can figure out what's going on? And they told him, like, yeah, no, he didn't make it through the night. And basically at that point, Dutch Mantel, Tony Atlas says Abdullah the Butcher was in this meeting. Abdullah says he was not in this meeting because he was a promoter and a booker. But there was some kind of conversation, meeting, something that happened in the hotel. And basically a lot of the wrestlers left Puerto Rico and a lot of them have never gone back. They all had to put in like police statements and everything about what happened the night of the incident, like when he got stabbed. But other than that, like nobody's really ever gone back to Puerto Rico, at least not to wrestle, like in a wrestling sense. A lot of them haven't gone back to Puerto Rico. Of course, the news of Brody's death traveled like wildfire. It got back to the States. It was all over Puerto Rico. Like everybody knew what was going on. His wife got to Puerto Rico, and when she got there, she saw Abdullah leaving. Like he was going in the airport while she was coming out, and she was like, hey, how's Brody? How's he doing? And like she doesn't find out that her husband is dead until she's walking out of an airport in Puerto Rico as she's like passing somebody on their way out. You get what I'm saying? Like she was like the last person to find out. But yeah, so now you would think that this case is like pretty cut and dry. Like they have a clear like story of like what they believe could have happened, but like no, that's not what happened. Jose Gonzalez is arrested. He goes to jail. He gets bailed out. He goes home. Again, the police do take statements from the wrestlers that are there. So Dutch Mantel, Tony Atlas, Abdullah the Butcher, like all these people have statements with the police. However, during this case, while they are talking to Jose, because Jose the whole time is now pleading self-defense. Now, we don't know what happened behind that door. But the prosecution really had no way to say, like, oh, no, he's lying. Like, there was no way they could definitively say he's lying. And the main reason for that is because, A, no one could find the knife. And, B, they sent out the summons for the people that they needed to come to court. But the summons didn't reach the people in the U.S. until after the verdict was reached. So they went through the entire case. They went through the prosecution and the defense talking and all of this stuff. And Jose being able to be like, it was self-defense. And you never got to hear anybody else's side of the story. I believe Tony Atlas said he never got his summons to come to court. Dutch Mantel said he got his 10 days after the verdict was read. So after the case was closed, verdict read, he is acquitted, he is a free man, there's nothing else to be done. That's when Dutch got his summons. Like, hey, you need to come to Puerto Rico to come to court. This case was handled so bad. So poorly. And like, the sad part is like when I'm researching this and I'm looking up like cases like this, just like in Puerto Rico, stuff like this is normal. This is not out of the norm. Like, especially for like that time, that's not out of the normal. And that was just how things went. So yeah, that case rubs me the wrong way. I think the case was handled poorly. I think it was bullshit. I think Jose should have been charged. Because at the end of the day, you stabbed a man and like your witnesses weren't there. And it, for the fact that like they didn't get their summons, like so many things is wrong with this case, but you know, judicial rules, I guess, whatever. So he will never be charged again for this. And he walks around saying that, you know, it's self-defense, that he did it, but it's self-defense. So yeah, this is the episode of Bruiser Brody. It is definitely kind of more on the shorter side, but I kind of wanted to like slow down, give you guys something a little simpler this week, because last week was definitely a crazy journey. Like, I'm still kind of just like, what the fuck was Ted doing? So yeah, that was a lot. So I hope you guys enjoyed this. Thank you for everyone who's been rocking with me these last couple of months. I know the last few weeks have been kind of crazy. I wasn't here one, I was here, you know, whatever. But yeah, I'm really grateful for everyone who has been supporting, who has been listening, who's been sharing, commenting, messaging me, like all of it. I truly, truly, truly appreciate you guys. You guys are amazing. You're awesome. So yeah, keep sharing the pod, keep sending me messages, keep commenting, keep listening. If you need to find me, you can find me on Instagram at True Crime Boulevard. That's TRUECRIMEBOVD. Or you can also find me at _ Bria Daniels, BRIADINIELS. That is my Instagram. If you guys want to get to know more about me, you guys can go and follow me over there. You can email me at truecrimeboulevard@gmail.com. Spelled the same way as the Instagram, TRUECRIMEBLBD@gmail.com. If you have any questions, if you have any episode suggestions, comments, you just want to say, hey, whatever, I'm here. I'm always going to respond. And again, thank you. And I will be back next week. See you guys later. Bye.